Operation back on the road here. Moving up to item 7B. Climate River Renewal Corporation and Development Corporation. Branson?
Good morning. I'm Mark Branson with the Klamath River Renewal Corporation. Chairman Valenzuela, the supervisors, thank you very much for the opportunity, the invitation to come and speak with you to provide some project updates and to answer questions. I'm joined today by Mort McMillan from McMillan Corporation, our owner's representative, and Ren Brownell, our public information officer. And Mort and Ren will both cover portions of today's presentation. We go to the next slide, please. So today we're going to provide a little bit of an overview of the project schedule. We'll talk about the status of the 2023 pre-drawdown construction activities. We were asked to provide a brief overview of some of our obligations under the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106. We'll talk about the 2024 drawdown schedule and activities. FEMA spoke to the flood mapping issues, but we can talk a little bit about some of the work that we've been doing there. And then Ren will provide an update for you all on some of the public information resources and outreach efforts that we are engaged in. I do want to take just a moment before we get any further into the presentation, though you can advance to the next slide. I want to, and Ren will touch on more of this, I want to point out, based on a public comment earlier today, that letters that are being received by residents are from the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, not from PacifiCorp. And we will provide, again today, contact information so that residents can directly reach out to the Renewal Corporation if they have any questions about any information they're receiving in those letters. Ren will also speak to some of the questions and concerns articulated this morning about docks. We do appreciate that Supervisor Chris and county staff have arranged for a community meeting tomorrow at the Kako Community Center, and I just wanted to let the board know that as part of our meetings tomorrow, we will be meeting with the Kako Community Fire Department, the chief, and perhaps others with the department to talk about some of the fire mitigation plan implementation and resources that are being made available to the firefighting agencies. FEMA coordination, I will hold that for the discussion in the presentation, as well as respond to some of the questions and comments about the mitigation fund and flood protection. So with that, if we can move into the next slides, I'm going to hand it over to Mort McMillan for the updates.
My name is Mort McMillan. I'm with McMillan Corporation, and I'm the owner's rep for the Renewal Corporation for the project implementation. And I'll just run through a quick overview of project schedule if we jump to the next slide. So what you see here basically is the timeline for the dam removal process. On the left-hand side there in 2023 is what we call our pre-drawdown activities. That's where we're making modifications to the dam to allow us to lower the reservoirs and do the sediment flushing. We're doing basically a Kako number one, and show a photograph a little bit. We're putting a low-level adit at the base of the dam. It's a 10-foot diameter hole that goes from the downstream face to within 12 feet of the upstream face. To initiate drawdown, we'll blast that last concrete plug out, and that'll open up the low-level adit. Kako number two, if you've been up there, is completely out. Not quite completely. We've got a little bit of foundation work, but it'll be out by the end of October. The intake will be plugged. Most of the power generation equipment, such as the Woodstave flow line, the penstocks, and the tunnel closures, will be complete by the end of October as well for Kako number two. At Iron Gate, we've done our gate testing. There's a gate that's there existing. We've done full testing on that. We've went in and installed a vent line. And basically, we've got one piece of work left. It'll occur end of October, first part of November, and then it's ready to go. So then as we go into drawdown, what will happen is we'll open our low-level outlets at J.C. Boyle, at Copco One and Iron Gate in January. We'll pull the reservoirs down depending on what the hydrology does. So if we have a really heavy snowpack, we may get flood releases from the Bureau out of Keno. We'll get a partial refill, then we'll go to final drawdown, final reservoir down to free-flowing stream in April, May timeframe, and we'll start the dam removal at that point. The dam removal will be done by September, volitional fish passage channels restored by the end of October 2024 at all four dams. The power generation equipment will be taken out during that period as well. We'll actually start a little bit earlier. We have some hazardous materials to take out of the powerhouses, lead paints and asbestos. We'll do all the abatement. That'll start in February. And then all the powerhouse equipment will be removed and disposed of off-site. A lot of the metals will be recycled. And that'll all be done on that same time frame. So at the end of October of 2024, all the dams are out. And basically all of the generation equipment is out. And then the restoration work will be occurring. All the plannings on the waste disposal sites. Res, who is our restoration contractor, will be doing plantings, seeding on the exposed reservoir surfaces. So that's the schedule that we're working towards. Next slides.
Mr. McMillan, if you could hold for just a sec. Angela, can you get the light switch that's furthest away from the door? I think it'll make it a lot easier to see.
Thank you. So just to show you a little bit of photos on the pre-drawdown here. Next slide. So this is basically Copco number two that we started with here at the beginning of the summer. If you go to the next slide, you can see that the dam is removed. Now all that's left is some foundation there in the center. You can see where the dirt road comes down to it. And that work is currently being removed right now. We've done a couple blasts to take the final concrete out. On the left-hand side, that structure has also been removed back to, will be removed back to the tunnel intake. We've got a concrete plug going on the tunnel intake that will be cast in place, and that seals up the tunnel both from the public access but also from water going into it when the river floods. And then we'll be establishing the final volitional channel through here. We have particular grades and channel sections we've developed for volitional fish passage. All that will be occurring here in October. Next slide. One of the things that was identified in Ward Canyon between Copco 2 diversion dam and the powerhouse, that area has a lot of vegetation, a lot of trees in the channel. So we coordinated with CDFW and the Whitewater community, identified those trees that are in the active channel, and we're taking 800 of those out right now. So those are being dropped and then flown out with a helicopter. We're temporarily storing them up in the cinder cone area. All that work will be done here by mid-October. Res is managing that effort. And that will restore a channel for whitewater to be able to go down through Ward Canyon without having hazard trees, maintaining riparian areas for the fish and wildlife aspects. Next slide. This is Copco number one. This is when we first started the adit. You can see we prepared the surface. And the adit basically is just another name for a low-level tunnel, per se, a conduit. And you can see we prepared it. This is a drill and shoot. So we basically drill, put explosive in, blast, and then work our way up to the face of the dam. If you go to the next slide, this shows you inside. This is basically the blasting team. They've drilled all the holes. They go in and load those, and then basically we shoot those, then we muck it out, and we come do it again. And the last shot on the adit was yesterday, so the adit basically is done. What happens now is we go in, there's a 10-foot diameter pipe that gets installed pretty much about where you can see where it looks like it's a wider opening at the outlet. That's 14.5 feet, goes in there. There's a concrete closure collar that goes around it, and then the 10-foot pipe comes out from there. Next slide. And this kind of shows you what I was just talking about. On the left-hand side is the adit that we just finished. What we're building now is on the right-hand side, so it's a 10-foot pipe. That gets encased in a riprap section. It's got a vent line on it. And that pad provides us access over to the diversion tunnel that will reopen as part of the drawdown work. We've also dredged up in the forebay. We have to reopen the channel that goes to the old diversion tunnel, so we've taken that material out. We've also opened up a path to the adit that's all been dredged. That'll be done in October, and then that material is disposed of up on the right-hand side on a bench, and then it'll be part of our restoration activities when we do the final reservoir restoration. Down at Iron Gate, I mentioned all of our work at Iron Gate has been in the existing diversion tunnel, which is on the right-hand side. There's an intake gatehouse you kind of see there right in the center, just before you get to the spillway. If you go to the next slide. What we did there is we went inside that tunnel and mounted a new vent line. So basically the water will go through a hydraulic jump inside the tunnel, so we have to have enough air so that it functions properly hydraulically. So there's a new HDPE air line you can see there. It gets mounted to the ceiling. If you go to the next slide, you can kind of see it there. This is the unlined portion of the tunnel. So that air line's all installed. It's rock anchored to the ceiling. The gate has been tested. There used to be what's called a blind flange on a concrete wall. We've removed that. The last piece we have to do is put a couple what's called super cavitation baffles on the concrete outlet. We'll be mounting those here at the first week of November, and then all this work is done and ready to go. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mort. If you'll go to the next slide, please. National Historic Preservation Act Section 106 compliance is one of the most important regulations that we are working on. Back in 2018, I convened a cultural resources working group made up of 14 affected tribes, state and federal agencies who have obligations under the National Historic Preservation Act for the protection of cultural resources, including tribal cultural resources and elements of the built environment. And the work that that working group did ultimately resulted in the production and preparation of a number of plans, including looting and vandalism, inadvertent discovery, programmatic agreement, and other documents that were submitted to FERC for approval as part of their consideration of our application for license surrender. And those plans were approved. We have tribal monitors that are out on the site on a daily basis. They are out establishing avoidance areas in advance of the construction work. They are preparing responses along with our archaeologists and other cultural resources specialists in the event that we have an inadvertent discovery. And we follow the plans and the protocols that were established under our Section 106 compliance document. That includes the development and submittal and then implementation of treatment plans, which are submitted to agencies, including the State Historic Preservation Office, the tribes, and other consulting parties for review and approval prior to implementation. If you go to the next slide, we have done significant training for our monitors and for the construction staff to ensure that everybody has a full and complete understanding of how to respond in the event of an archaeological discovery, an inadvertent discovery of an artifact or the inadvertent discovery of something from the built environment, something from the original construction of the dams. The various phases of implementation of those protocols basically begin with suspending the work, with protecting the resource that has been discovered, notifying the appropriate entities, beginning with the on-site cultural resources specialist or archaeological resource, and then maintaining confidentiality and protection of those sites. Following those notifications and protections, then we do an assessment and further notifications as may be required. That describes the process in the event of the discovery of a cultural artifact. If you go to the next slide, we have very similar protocols in the event that we discover human remains. The difference in this protocol is that, of course, we're required to notify the county coroner. And the coroner will come out and inspect the site and or inspect any human remains that may be brought into the coroner's office for purposes of determining whether we are looking at some indigenous burial or whether we may have unearthed a crime scene. Assuming that we have discovered an indigenous burial, human remains associated or affiliated with one of the local tribes, the coroner then will assist the Renewal Corporation and the consulting parties through a notification process to the Native American Heritage Commission, who has the responsibility for determining the appropriate Native American tribe that is what is referred to as the most likely descendant. So in the event of the discovery of human remains, the goal is to make a determination as to which tribe today is the most likely descendant based on the location, the nature of the burial, the nature of the find, and allowing that tribe then to come in and determine appropriate and respectful disposition of that human remain. And so all of our on-site construction folks, as well as our tribal monitors and cultural archaeologists and others, are familiar with these protocols and practice these protocols as may be appropriate. If you go to the next slide, please. In addition to those protocols on the ground, we do provide regular updates to the consulting parties. We have developed an interpretive plan that is investigating potential future uses of the facilities and the sites. We have implemented a see and say program. This is an opportunity for anyone who may witness looting and vandalism or believe that they may be witnessing or have witnessed looting and vandalism of a tribal cultural resource to report that information. We will be providing monetary rewards. We've developed an adaptive reuse plan to help determine whether there might be interested parties or potential uses for some of the facilities associated with the hydroelectric project that one or more parties may have interest in utilizing or developing under the adaptive reuse plan. And then we continue to do various trainings and implementation of these practices and procedures, including tribal monitoring, law enforcement training, and contractor training. And then if you'll just go to that that last slide on this. The CNSA program, just a little bit more detail. We have established a direct phone line and email for purposes of allowing people to do a reporting of trespassing or looting or vandalism of any cultural resources. And as I mentioned, we are providing financial rewards to informants whose tips lead to identification, citation, arrest of looters or vandals. We take that responsibility to protect cultural resources very seriously. We're required to do that under the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106, and we continue to implement our compliance obligations in close coordination with the tribal partners. So I just wanted to highlight some of the things that we're doing under National Historic Preservation Act. So we'll go to the next slide, and I'll hand it back to Morton.
Before you, through the chair, can I just ask a quick question? What tribes are involved? Is it complete from downriver to above in Oregon, Klamath, and Modoc are included as well as all downriver?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Supervisor Kobseff. We have engaged all 14 of the affected tribes from the mouth of the river to the headwaters, including Klamath tribes and Modoc. We currently have Shasta Indian Nation and Klamath tribes under contract to the Renewal Corporation to provide archaeological and cultural monitoring services on the project. And are employing a number of those cultural monitors. The consulting parties is a large group of tribes and entities, including state and federal regulators, who have interest in our compliance activities under Section 106, and that does include all of the tribes up and down the entire
Thank
river
you.
Corridor.
Just to provide a little bit more detail on the drawdown, if you can jump to the next slide. This is the schematic that shows the phases that we'll be going through. And as I mentioned before, the 2023 is our pre-drawdown work, which we'll be completing here in October, November. Then we initiate the drawdown in January. We anticipate that drawdown period will be complete in March, out in through the April timeframe. And then you'll basically see the dam removal start, and then the restoration work occur in the fall. The only factor, as I mentioned before, that changes that, it just depends on what we get coming out of the hydrology from the Klamath Lake watershed. We've been working with the Bureau for multiple years now on flow projections, coordination with them in terms of the flow releases and the buyout requirements and all of that. So those discussions are ongoing. We'll continue all the way through when we initiate the drawdown and then we initiate the dam removal process. And that also includes all the tribal entities and the agencies are involved in that discussion. Next. There's 17 to 20 million cubic yards of sediment that's in the reservoirs behind the dams. We anticipate 5 to 7 million cubic yards will come out and go out with that flush that occurs between January and March. There's been extensive sampling of that sediment. That went to the Corps of Engineers and EPA. They reviewed all of that data. There's actually a sediment center out of Portland, Oregon that the Corps maintains. They do all of the sediment analysis nationwide for the Corps. And they came back and concluded independently that that material is non-toxic. It's organic material, but we don't have anything in it that is hazardous. And basically, we did issue letters downstream, the Renewal Corporation, notifying them that there will be sediments coming out and they can contact the Renewal Corporation related to that as far as assessment. And I've been working on some of those, reaching with meeting with a couple of landowners associated with that. Next. Now I'm going to turn it back to Mark on the floodplain mapping part of it.
Can I ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
Can you go back a couple, one more?
Yeah.
So right there, explain to me four, dam demolition and then Klamath River reconnection. And five, you've got breaching. Explain those differences between four and five, the orange and the blue, because you're saying that it will be open by October for fish passage, but that
fish
blue looks a little different.
So at each one of these dams, up to J.C. Boyle, when they built the dam, they diverted the river under this, what's now the spillway. And there's two concrete conduits that go under. They put stop logs in it when they filled the river. We're going to do it in reverse. We're going to take the stop logs out, divert the river through it, remove the embankment section. And then when we get to the final end, when we do the final breach of the embankment section, that's what that means, is we basically cut the final hole in it, restore the river through it, and then basically move the river back into the final channel. The actual final connection is basically the final grading through the channel. We have specific parameters for the slope, the channel width, and then the erosion protection. All of that occurs in that late September to October time frame. When you go to COPCO, it's different. COPCO is a concrete dam. When we get down below the adit, we reopen the old diversion tunnel. We move the river through that, and we take the entire dam all the way down to the foundation. Once we get it down to that, then basically we do the final restoration, and we breach that final cofferdam as well, and then move the river back into the final channel. And then at Iron Gate, the original cofferdam was incorporated into the upstream face of the dam. So it's still there. It's part of that embankment section. We move the river over into the old diversion tunnel. We'll take out the dam all the way down, and then we bring the downstream tow upstream. And then we basically get to that original cofferdam. We do a breach on that, remove that material, near the final volitional channel. And that occurs out there in that late September, October. The breach is in September. So the final volitional fish passage, truly done, the river's back in its natural course, is around the end of October is when that occurs.
So in that time frame, September, October, where is the greatest amount of sediment release going to occur?
It'll occur late September from Iron Gate, mid-September, not late.
Mid-September.
Yeah. And it'll be just a few days when we do that final breach, basically to get it down, and then we'll be removing it from the banks at that point.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Special
clarification. So late September, the rest of that, say, 12 million?
No. The majority of the sediment will come out during the initial flush, which is the January to March. That last breach that we do, that would be just in the channel upstream, the reservoir's already all the way down, so all the sediments out in the overbank areas will be unimpacted. It'll just be the main channel right in front of the old cofferdam.
Okay, so 17 to 20 million cubic yards of sediment overall.
Correct.
5 to 7 million cubic yards are going to come downstream
The rest will be maintained in the overbank areas and stabilized and planted.
Okay, so that won't come down?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
John?
How many yards, cubic yards are there in the Iron Gate itself, and where is the disposal site for that?
So Iron Gate Dam has 1 million cubic yards of material, and the disposal site is on the left abutment, up where the old shooting range is, and that's where the material originally came from. So it's all basically going back where they got it when they built the dam. That's where a bunch of it's going. The spillway, we'll be backfilling the spillway with material as well. So that'll be blended into the right abutment there. So either go there or go on the top of the waste disposal site on the left abutment.
Okay. So, Chris?
No. Go ahead. Thank you. The question I have for the number three, and then I guess would relate to 4 and 5 also, for the rising of the reservoir, is there going to be a need for additional water for flushing of sediment?
So there's been a lot of discussion about sediment flushing.
Yeah.
Where we're at right now is basically, it depends again on the hydrology and the demands. As you probably are fairly aware, there's a lot of need for water in the basin upstream. Been a lot of discussion with the Bureau, depending on what we get. If it's another drought year, we won't have water available for additional sediment flushing. So what would happen is we'll take our drawdown, we'll take whatever comes from the Bureau, then we'll start the stabilization process. If there's water available, then we'll basically partially refill, and then we'll draw it down again, and that will be the supplemental flushing that would occur at that point. But it all depends on what the hydrology is that we get from the upper basin, which the Bureau controls.
And you don't have any target acre feet volume or water that you feel required?
The amount of water that we're pulling from the reservoirs themselves will give us the baseline sediment flushing we're looking for. There's different levels and different models been run looking at, you know, supplemental flushing. I can't give you the exact number off the top of my head, but we can follow up with that.
Basically, if all that was done was the baseline, thumbs up, in your opinion, that would be good, or is there additional need for flushing?
The discussion has been, you know, additional flushing is always beneficial. From being able to just move as much sediment as we can out during this initial dam removal and reservoir drawdown. So yeah, it would be beneficial to us.
Right.
Is it required for us to be able to finish the project and stabilize the sediment in place? No, it's not.
Is it? Okay.
But yeah, our goal would be is to get as much water as we can to flush as much sediment as we can.
Right.
But again, we got to deal with you know, Mother Nature and what she's going to give to us, and then the Bureau as well.
One more go back. You do have an initial drawdown period. Do you have a cap on the maximum amount you can release? And what does that look like at the first gauge, which is the SIAD gauge?
Cap on?
How much you can release at once?
Flow.
So the hydraulic capacity of the Iron Gate Tunnel is 4,000 CFS. So that's what we're going to start out releasing.
You know what that looks like in river elevation down the river?
Not off the top of my head, no, but we can get that for
you. Does anybody know? I hope somebody knows.
Good. Hey, you said you can get that information to me.
Correct.
I'd appreciate that.
Thanks.
Anything else? Greg?
No.
Thank you, Chairman. I want to just add one point to Mort's response to Supervisor Chris's question about flow releases. I just want to clarify that under no circumstances will the Renewal Corporation request additional water from Upper Klamath Lake for purposes of mobilizing and evacuating sediment from behind the reservoirs. The only condition that would allow for additional water is if Mother Nature blesses us with a large snowpack and spring runoff, or the Bureau finds themselves operating the Upper Klamath Lake in flood management condition, in which case they may release additional water, and as Mort has indicated, that would be beneficial to us. But just to clarify that we will not request additional releases from Upper Klamath Lake. We have no water right or ability or expectation that water would be available but for a large snowpack and a large spring runoff condition.
Thank you for the follow-up there.
You're welcome. Just next slide. We will provide Supervisor Halke information you're requesting. I'll just note that 4,000 CFS is, of course, two-thirds of the flow that is often released from Upper Klamath Lake, to 6,000 cubic feet per second for the flushing flow. So that flow, you know, moves through the river almost on an annual basis. We don't anticipate releasing anything above 4,000 CFS. And the 6,000 CFS flushing flow does not overtop, you know, the riverbank, and that's certainly our goal. And I'll just add also that the rationale for the drawdown period beginning in January and extending into the March time frame is a regulatory and fisheries-driven window for us. It is the period during which there is the least biological activity in the main stem of the Klamath River. And so we basically have been directed to do the drawdown during this period when the sediment flush is expected to have the least biological impact. And as Mort noted, we have notified all of the downstream landowners and land stewards exactly what they can expect to see. And we do know with a little bit of precision through the sediment modeling where that sediment will model out. I do want to just comment on a couple of the FEMA questions and the FEMA discussion. I personally did not recognize the names of the FEMA individuals who spoke earlier today, but I will note for the board that the Renewal Corporation has coordinated with FEMA, as we have with other federal agencies, during the development of not only the definite deconstruction plan, which was filed and approved by FERC, but also the development of federal permits, including the 404. So close coordination between the Corps of Engineers and FEMA for purposes of looking out to the impacts and the development of the 404 and other federal permits. Certainly, FERC considered the data that has been developed as part of the preparation of the definitive deconstruction plan. We did do an update to the existing 100-year floodplain. And so the regulators have been encouraging the Renewal Corporation and others to utilize the updated floodplain that was developed based on the very best information we have about the post-dam removal condition. So I just want to be clear that there is modeling and mapping available that was filed as part of our environmental reviews that shows what the anticipated flood conditions will look like, what the floodplain boundaries will look like for a post-dam 100-year event. And the Renewal Corporation is very clear on what our obligations will be with regard to coordination with FEMA for purposes of doing future modeling and mapping and working with FEMA for purposes of FEMA developing an updated flood insurance study and preparing new flood mappings. The last point I want to make on flooding is that when I don't speak for the mitigation fund, but I will note that the mitigation fund contacted every single one of the 38 property owners below Iron Gate Dam who have facilities, homes, or uninhabitable structures that could be impacted by an increase in the 100-year flood post-dam removal. And most of those, or many of those property owners, have responded to the communication they received from the Klamath Mitigation Fund and are working with them with the mitigation fund for purposes of selecting options and receiving financial compensation to do flood hardening or other flood improvements for their facilities. Out of the 38 facilities, structures that we identified and that the Klamath Mitigation Fund has communicated to those property owners, 34 of those 38 are already within the 100-year floodplain today. What our current mapping and modeling shows for a post-dam condition is that some of those properties are subject to an additional 6 to 18 inches of potential flooding. And that's the reason that the mitigation fund is working with those property owners to have engineers and construction contractors come out and do an alternatives analysis on a property-by-property basis, which the Renewal Corporation with the mitigation fund is evaluating for purposes of issuing financial resources to those property owners who may choose to implement an alternative to further protect their properties from flooding conditions for the post-dam removal condition. So I just wanted to provide the board with some insight into exactly what the work is that's being done with those property owners between Iron Gate and Humbug Creek for purposes of ensuring that they have the ability to take measures in advance of drawdown to protect themselves from any potential future flooding they may see. And then that work will follow, as was described by FEMA and mentioned by Mort, that once the dams are out and the river channel has stabilized, then that updated FEMA process will unfold. So with that, let me move to the next slide, and I believe we have Rand providing a little bit of information.
See what the cost of
yes,
well.
So I appreciate your comments, but it's kind of contradictory to what we heard from FEMA, since they didn't know anything about the project, because they said that no one has put an application or provided data. So how do you reconcile that?
I don't disagree with that comment. We have not provided any information which would be irrelevant at this point, as we've discussed. Once the dams are removed and we know where the river channel is, that's the appropriate point in time at which we would do the modeling and the updated mapping. But we did see coordination with the Corps of Engineers and FEMA during the development and review of the definitive plan for deconstruction, as well as the Corps' development of our Clean Water Act Section 404 permit.
So my understanding was, and I may be wrong, that the mitigation fund had a deadline of being able to apply for this flood part of, you know, receiving some type of funding. But if you don't know what this is going to look like for maybe 3 years out, it appeared that those that the mitigation fund wouldn't be able to assist in that capacity.
Yeah, let me try to clarify. The renewal project did develop a 100-year floodplain map for a post-dam condition. Now, it has some uncertainty, but it was based on the best available information. That is the basis for the work that the Renewal Corporation and the Mitigation Fund are doing with these property owners for purposes of identifying potential options to put in flood protections. So they are working from mapping for a post-dam removal condition. That's the reason we know that those 38 properties are subject to somewhere between 6 and 18 inches of additional 100-year flooding, and that's the basis for the design and the construction of those potential options. And with regard to deadlines that were imposed by the mitigation fund, the rationale behind that was really simply to try to encourage people to get moving on this before drawdown, to allow property owners as much time as possible to implement a solution with the financial resources that the mitigation fund is providing, should those property owners decide to use that financial resource to implement something. That we've been flexible on that deadline. We're continuing even today to work with those property owners for purposes of selecting an option and getting a contractor on board and getting them those financial resources from the mitigation fund to pay that contractor to do those flood improvements. So that process is ongoing, and we remain very flexible, as does the mitigation fund, on deadlines. Our goal is simply to try to give people as much opportunity to implement in advance of drawdown.
Thank you.
So I think in your response to that, you should be able to see the frustration from that standpoint. I've been cut out of the process completely with the mitigation fund. I'm not allowed to talk to the fund managers, not allowed to talk to the people that are maybe having this work done, but I've got a building department operating in the dark, trying to process building permits. How do we make this work?
Well, then I don't see a challenge, and I'm open to further discussion about the relationship between the building department and the mitigation fund. The mitigation fund is a confidential claims process with property owners who may experience some direct project impact from dam removal. That is the entire premise and the function of the mitigation fund. If the mitigation fund, or if the implementation of an alternative or a solution is running up against issues with the building department because of lack of information, then the mitigation fund and the Renewal Corporation would be happy to engage for purposes of unsticking whatever may be stuck there.
Well, somebody's going to have to communicate with us, because from the very beginning we've been told, well, they might build walls around your place, they might elevate a place. Somebody's going to have to get a building permit for that. And we're going to have to know specifically what your entity is going to stand behind for funding to be able to process that.
Understood. Happy to have those discussions, and I can speak on a limited basis to, you know, to that process.
Speak that man right back there.
Yeah, well, we continue to be in cooperation and coordination.
Is
that it?
Yeah, you run it into the question.
I would like to allow
that's
Brent
right.
Bernal.
The first half of that.
I want to see if any of these board members have any more questions. Did you have anything for Sue Chris?
I did. We have a few questions.
Yeah, please ask one.
Some of the questions here, for the CNSA, I'll take the easy ones first. The CNSA, for the $1,000, how long is that in place, the $1,000 fine for the looting of Native American sites?
Yeah, that will be in place for the duration of our obligation under FERC's license surrender order. It puts us out to 2030, 2031, something like that.
All right.
And let me just comment to conclude that, Supervisor Chris, that at that point in time, if not sooner, those properties which are subject to this monitoring and oversight will be transferring from the Renewal Corporation to the states of California or Oregon or one of the state's third-party designees. So that at that point, the land transfer, the obligation of the Renewal Corporation terminates.
All right. I was told that in the cement, there's asbestos in the cement for the dams. For air pollution and air quality, I'm not trying to pick on the spot, just legitimate, you know, concern people have is that asbestos was used in the concrete when it was manufactured at the time for the dams, air quality standards that would be put in place for the downwind constituents.
So I'm aware of the analysis that was done, and we can get that for you. Basically, the measures that we put in place for dust control and all of those items were designed around mitigating that. And as far as the levels of asbestos and those type of things, I don't know off the top of my head, but we do have an analysis that looked at that.
Right. And then mitigated in your...
Correct.
Right. For the burials, I take it those are... I wrote this just before the presentation. For the burials, how many have been found? Can you state that?
That's confidential information. Yeah, we won't discuss the inadvertent discoveries of human remains beyond what information may be made public or through the coroner's office.
Right. And then for the mitigation fund, we talked about this last time you came here before us. $5,000 per well, I think $17,000 for flood slope. I'm trying to remember all the exact numbers here, but when people added those numbers up, they didn't add up to $25 million. And so, can you say how much of that's been spent? Or, not saying specific clients, but how much of the mitigation fund has been spent to mitigate?
Yeah, the $5,000 per well was the only fixed amount for the categories. So for the rim stability and flood impacts, those numbers are not capped. So those are subject to negotiation, confidential negotiations with the fund and the individual property owners. And with regard to the amount spent, I don't know. That number, I know that we have had significant number of property owners who have received financial resources for each of the categories, and more to come as we continue the work with the property owners, particularly on the rim stability issues and the flood issues.
And are your consultants advising them on, because not everyone's going to be an expert on rim stability, are your providing that technical expertise?
Yeah, we are providing technical expertise and also encouraging property owners to seek out independent technical expertise and advice and providing them with potential resources to consider.
If it's possible, if was the fund designated towards, was it $25 million that was designated towards?
The total capitalization of the mitigation fund is not a public number.
It is a public number. With that, stop there for a
second.
Thank you. When I was reading through Chelsea's staff report, I found the list reports, the agency reports, FERC reports, and the back and forth between KRRC and FERC. And I found it interesting that your monthly reports were generally sent in to FERC about a month behind your work reports. And then there weren't really any, I found a few rebuttals back from FERC to your reports that went in. And I'm curious about the accountability that goes along with that. There's a kind of a big delay in the work that's being done to the reporting and then how those rebuttals are being handled. So can you address that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Supervisor Ogren. Thanks for the question. I'll point out that the Renewal Corporation, our contractors, and our owner's representative interact with FERC at multiple levels. And so what you're referring to is the monthly construction reports or the cultural resources or biological survey and monitoring reports that we file. And there is a bit of a lag time between the collection and the processing of the information, the preparation of the report and filing. And that is filings that are made to the Office of Energy Projects at the sort of federal level. But on a daily and weekly and monthly basis, the Renewal Corporation is engaging with the Dam Safety Regional Office of FERC. They have been on site for purposes of doing inspections. We are communicating with them on an almost daily basis for purposes of some of the pre-drawdown construction work. For example, we file a pre-blasting report at least 24 hours in advance of one of the blasts that Mark talked about at the COPCO added, and we file no later than 24 hours after a blast, a post-blast report with FERC. So we are filing those reports with FERC as well as with the California Division of Safety of Dams for purposes of ensuring that they have the opportunity to review and comment on ongoing work. So that's sort of two examples of how we are interacting with FERC. And then if I can just sort of say in the middle, we have an independent board of consultants with whom we are meeting and conferring on a regular basis so that the BOC, the Board of Consultants, an independent group of engineers and hydraulic folks and dam safety folks can review our proposed plans and comment on those. And those are things that FERC then relies on for purposes of providing us feedback and making recommendations or requirements for adjustments to our plans. So FERC relies on our work with the independent board of consultants to review our proposed plans for decommissioning or for mitigations of some form. And that is sort of the back and forth, the comment, and the regulatory oversight that FERC utilizes on our evolving decommissioning plans. So FERC is very much engaged at least those three levels, and that can range from sort of a daily basis, looking at work proposed for the following 24 hours, to reviewing a report from the previous month's construction or biological monitoring or what have you.
Thank you. I also noticed that there were a few reports that were considered not public.
That's correct. Yes, a number of the filings that we make with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission are protected under rules, many of which stem from 9/11, that protect critical energy infrastructure so that information is not public. Some of the information that we provide to FERC includes specific information on the location of facilities within a power generating facility or a dam that could be utilized by parties for purposes of assessing vulnerabilities. And that's why that information is protected. It certainly is not the Renewal Corporation's intent to hide this information from the public. We're simply complying with federal laws that protect critical energy infrastructure information so that it doesn't get into the wrong hands.
Is there a way to address those documents with a cover sheet that would say something to that effect to let the public know and us that those are infrastructure, not for public information, so that at least we know that that's what that's for?
Yeah, every filing that we make that is subject to CEII, Critical Energy Infrastructure Information Protocols and Procedures, is labeled accordingly. Or we make a request for FERC to treat it under CEII procedures and protocols. So everything we file that could potentially be within the purview of CEII is either labeled that way, or our cover letter makes a request. FERC holds those documents private until they make a determination as to whether they will acknowledge and accept our request to protect those.
Okay, so that they're identified, so at least we don't just say not for public.
That's correct. And you know, with Ren, our public information officer, now on board, I believe that that folks have seen or have the opportunity to see a significant uptick in access and availability to to information like these photos that we've shown you. We want to allow for the public to have the opportunity and the board, for example, to be able to see some of the work that's going on and on a real-time basis. And so we're working hard to keep our social media up to date and do presentations of today's nature so that people have the opportunity to really see almost real-time photographs and other images of the work. And we certainly appreciate the ongoing discussions about providing some live webcam-based sort of opportunity for people to see the work as we can work that through with our contractors who have some concerns and those kinds of issues. So we have to comply with these federal requirements for CEII. At the same time, we're working hard to try to elevate the profile for the public to be able to see what's going on.
No, understood, and it's always nice for the public to understand what that entails, just so that it doesn't look like there's anything being hidden, unless, of course, it's mandated.
And yeah, precisely. Thank you. May
you.
I have, I'd like to introduce Ren Brunell again, our public information officer, to provide a little bit of an oversight on that sample work.
Hello, everyone. Like Mark noted, my name is Ren Brownell. I'm the Public Information Officer. I have been on board since about June. I'm originally from Siskiyou County. I grew up between Scott Valley and Syed Valley, and I live down the Klamath River now. Up on the screen here, you can find my contact information, both my direct email and phone line. You can also see some of the other places that we post public information. Now, I know not everybody is on the internet, so we also do a lot of in-person outreach. We will be joining Brandon tomorrow in COTCO, and we have several other meetings coming up in the next month. We're going to work our way downriver because we want people to be well prepared for drawdown. I also want to note that if these modes of communication are not working for river communities, then I would be happy to be a sticker around, especially for people who may be present in the room. And you're also free, anybody who's online, free to give me a call. We can have a conversation about this because my priority is to provide timely and accurate information, and if these modes of communication are not working for you, let's find some other solutions, because I definitely want everybody to have the information that they need. That's mostly, I'm just coming up here to introduce myself and share my contact information, but I also do want to quickly address some questions that we heard. One of them is about the dock removal. I've received several phone calls of people inquiring about that as well, and we won't be removing any permanent structures. So we're only moving the fluctuating kind of ramps and then the floating docks themselves. No costs related to that are put on the property owners. They will, we have crews will come out and do that work. And the only communication that is required is if you would like to keep your dock. Then there's an agreement that must be signed just so we have access to your property so that a dock can be placed on your property. And as far as those permanent structures, like I said, we're not going to be adjusting any of those permanent structures. In the post that you mentioned, Brandon, there was a structure that went out into the water. Now, the reservoir itself and the land that are beneath it, they were PacifiCorp's property, now they are KRRC's property. And when the project is done, we will transfer those lands to the states where their third party designee. So I can't speak to what, the entity that owns these lands in the future might do with any sort of decks or structures that extend out into that property, but we have no intention.
This is a follow-up. It's such a huge blow to this community, not to argue, just such a huge blow to lose the dam, that it's kind of a small victory to keep that in. I know there's one constituent there for the dock removal. She was concerned about citing the document for the DACA rule because of all the clauses in it. Just you get all these legalese into it that actually scares people away. I haven't read the form myself, but just, you know, human nature scares you away. I can connect you with her afterwards because she wanted her DACA moved. She's trying to find a contractor, but she was scared to sign the KRC one, which I respect, because just all the legalese, whoa, I didn't want to expose anything. So I just can't do that person.
I'd be happy to have a conversation with them, but just to clarify, too, is that she doesn't have to sign anything for the docs to be removed. It's only a property access agreement. If somebody would like to keep their doc, then we have to have the ability to go and place it on her property. But happy to have that discussion. And just, if there's no more questions on the docs.
And just to let people know, the reason for the meeting at COPCO, we were asked about it a while back. Why don't we wait until January? But if you live at COPCO, you're washing the dishes, you're looking out the windows on your mind all the time. So we wanted to have this meeting early on in order to
know
what's going on.
So absolutely, I completely agree. And as we kind of touched on today, there are certain ones that are approaching. COVE is going to close. And there are things that are very specific to the communities that live around the reservoirs that we want to be able to address. And our presentation, we tried to keep it concise today because the supervisors have met with KRC before and may be more well-informed, but we've prepared a more lengthy presentation for community members tomorrow so that they can have all the information they need. And then just really quickly, the other question I wanted to address is that somebody asked about the suckerfish that may be in the lake, the endangered suckerfish, the quam and coptu, and we did, before we started any deconstruction activities, our restoration contractors did do a suckerfish relocation effort in collaboration with the Klamath tribes. So they went out over the course of a couple weeks and harvested about, I think, 500 suckerfish that were relocated up to the Klamath tribes fish hatchery.
Questions? You want to come up?
I don't think he's done.
Oh,
so.
Sorry. I can't tell. You know, the last time you guys step back, if you're done or not done. Go ahead.
I should have been done, but no. Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Redcox. There's been some concern around the lake edge. The water's been fluctuating since 2015. It was drawn down to release water due to safe enough for upper basin. There's vegetation around the side that's died off, and around certain areas. So people are worried about herbicides, so for the questions tomorrow, you may very well get asked for any herbicides used. Because in the past, that lake's been drawn down, the vegetation stayed alive. This year, the water went down, the vegetation died. So you may very well be asked that question tomorrow. And the concern community members have is, hey, was herbicides used, anything dangerous? Because trees in lawn and yards have actually died, which is unusual for what they've experienced in the past.
So there's been no general spraying of herbicides on site. That's not to say that the restoration crews, they may use specific herbicides in very specific situations. If there's a specific instance, pernicious, noxious weed or something like that. But generally speaking, we limit herbicide use as much as possible. And a lot of that comes out from collaborating with tribes as well, because a lot of the tribes in our area, they've been equally beautiful baskets, right? And a lot of these basketry materials that grow from up in the COPCO area all the way to downriver, we will hold them in their mouths while they're weaving their baskets. And so it's very important to not spray any sort of herbicides or pesticides in the area that might affect people's health.
Thank you. That's my final
question.
The suckerfish relocation, but here it went to kind of tribe hatchery, but I thought some went out to the refuge as well, where there's not much water. Am I incorrect in that?
Yeah, Supervisor Kopsup, that's correct. Some of the fish from the California reservoirs were relocated to the lower wildlife refuge with cooperation of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The sucker salvaged from the boil reservoir were relocated to the Klamath tribes facilities in Oregon for subsequent release following some genetic testing and some other work that was being done.
So was there water where they were relocated or not? Or was it dewatered?
I'll respond based on my understanding is that conditions were appropriate for the fish to be
and you're
released
still
into the lower refuge.
Okay.
You're looking at the department.
Yeah, I'm seeing it. Not yes. Okay.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
You have something. Yeah. So, Mike Harris, Cal Fish and Wildlife. So they were moved to the refuge. They are in a pond where they previously
had several relocations before. It's got its own water source, and they're being monitored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And just like the Oregon fish, as soon as the genetics are figured out, they'll figure out the best place to move them to based on the different genetics of the different subpopulations. So.
Okay, thank you. Susan?
Yeah, so Ren, you probably don't remember me, but I met you when you were in high school, I think. I'm the one that's pushing hard on cameras as well, and since I'm speaking to you, I thought I'd present it directly to you. What my concern is next year, and because there's so much hype along the West Coast about what's taking place up here, I'm worried about crowd control when this happens, and I'm looking for some kind of a public plan. It includes cameras, that's great. It includes other things, that's great too. But I don't want our sheriff's department saddled with trying to keep the peace of every looky-loo that comes here from all over the globe to see what's going on. That's specifically why I'm pushing on that.
I completely agree with everything that you've said. And we will develop some sort of plan, and I'll let you know what kind of resolution we come to. I have been trying to work internally about doing some sort of live setup. I'll be frank that I'm not sure it'll be possible for the entire duration of the project, but I think it could be very possible during key moments, and I think that could help with crowds. And we share those same concerns as well, because it's a dangerous construction site, and we don't want people ending up in a dangerous situation.
Will we consider signage like at the I-5 exit? Or something to inform the public, don't go this direction. Go. I mean, I don't need a bottleneck.
I know as far as signage along the highways, I know that we worked with Caltrans to remove the signage that pointed people towards the direction of the Iron Gate Reservoir, so that people who just happen to be driving on I-5 wouldn't turn and head up that direction.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I look forward to more discussion.
Thank you. You want to wrap it up? I have a couple of public comments. So.
Yeah, of course. Chairman Valenzuela, supervisors, again, thank you for the invitation to be here today. We look forward to future conversations and engagement with county staff on these important issues. So
I'm glad you have a public information officer. I hope it starts smoothing out some of the communications. I think the only way we're going to survive this whole process is to have open communications to rectify some of those.
Couldn't agree more. Nobody more excited to have Ren on board than me.
Okay, a couple of public comments. Roddy M. Roddy?
Is it Randy?
I'm sorry, I can't read people's handwriting.
Yeah,
Randy?
I can't write that well. And I'm sorry, I can't see all your names either.
That's okay.
Thank you for everybody here.
You gotta state your name and speak to the board.
And give us this opportunity to speak.
But we need your name for the record.
Randy, R-A-N-D-Y.
Thank you.
Murien, M-U-R-I-E-E-N.
E-E-N, thank you.
So I'm a third generation of a fourth generation Siskiyou County family that has lived from Cocco to Horse Creek doing agriculture and logging. Most of us are still in the county. And my concern is if all of you would just come down the river now and see the amount of sediment. You guys call it sediment. I call it rocks and boulders and gravel. Literally mountains coming down the draws and into the river to the point of almost damming the river up in certain places. So if there's been a study on that, it would be very reasonable in my mind for all of you to just go down there and look at it. And then you would see that, you know, firsthand what has happened there just from the floods. And I can remember the 1964-65 flood, and this has been the worst washouts into the river since then. But The point is, if you would come down there and see it, all of you could understand more what would happen when all of this, quote, sediment is released from the dam. And that sediment is not rocks and gravel like this. That sediment is from Klamath Falls area. That's all the organic dirt. So when that washes on to down the river, you will lose all your spawning grounds. I can remember my parents talking, they lived at Copco at the time, when the salmon were so thick that it was common practice for all those farmers and ranchers up there to take a pitchfork and catch their salmon. I've seen the decline of the fish since I was in the 30s, so ever since then. But weren't all those dams put in for flood control? All of them, I think. But especially Iron Gate, after the 64-65 flood, that was its purpose of going in. So I may have even built in the floodplain. And my question is, since Siskiyou County approved those permits for us to build in the 100-year floodplain, and if our houses do flood, who's going to pay? Why should we be required to get insurance if you guys okayed the permits that it was safe to build?
Thank you. Ms. Patrick Lupi.
Yeah, thank you again.
Debbie Bocciolippi again. First of all, I think these rooms should still be stocked full with people who are concerned about this. The conversations that we've had here, the pictures that we saw earlier showing destruction already of clean, green, renewable, multi-beneficial drought control, flood control, irrigation, fire suppression, recreation, a scenic byway, habitat, the home for fauna, flora, people, animals for decades being destroyed by, quote, a blasting team and others who live far away who knows, make probably a six-figure income to do this. The owner's representative probably makes way more than that. This just grabs at my heart still. It's shameful. It's just shameful. And I think that people who are a part of this should be ashamed. You know, we keep hearing best available. I heard an attorney, an environmental attorney out of Washington, D.C. this weekend at the Stop the 30 by 30 Summit say anytime you hear best available, it's only someone's opinion. And all these years, the 20 years that many of us have been involved in this, we've heard maybe, should, could, would, and we're still hearing that today. The Elwood Dams, if you look at the Elwood Dams today, there is a flat line in the Chinook recovery, a flat line in the past decades. They were told that the Chinook would return, and that is not true. They would put a five-year moratorium on the fishing in the Elwood, and there's still a flat line in the recovery and the return of the coho. I was at this summit, as I mentioned, and I knew that the Klamath River Dams would come up. And they did. And so anyway, I looked up the Shasta people who were not contacted, by the way. I just contacted the chief of the Shasta Nation, and he told me he has not been contacted about the Antiquity Act and the fines that are coming up in the Klamath so far. I heard there has been one fine, and a ruin. And the project did not stop, where if we, as a public entity, we would be stopped in the project until all the antiquities were found. But anyway, in this Wikipedia, it says, coho salmon were traditionally a major source of nutrition for the Shasta, talking about the Shasta people. And if you talk to the Shasta people, if you actually talk to the Shasta people, you would find out their territory is this area, it is where the dams are. And they would tell you, no, that was not our sustenance. The coho were not. Other salmon, yes, but not the coho. They didn't come up here. They were too weak of a fish. And I just want to make this final point. There is not one road, not street, not lane named after coho in this area. So if that fish were so important to this area, you would see, just like Chinook and other salmon and other fish in this area, you probably would see a street named after them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Efford.
Thank you, Steve Radford. I want to appreciate, give you guys a little applause, applaud you guys today for your diligence in the questioning that's been going on and representing our county. I really appreciate your comments this morning. Again, I want to bring up the bond issue. There's so many questions here that are so out there, way far out there, that nobody can really honestly address or answer. So that bond issue should come to fruition and be a big part of the next conversation in the next couple of days or weeks. Also, the road and bridge thing, being a builder, it just doesn't make any sense that these big trucks can go up and down that road that I've ridden on many times in the last 14 years that I've lived here. And it's a bouncy, bumpy road and not very comfortable. And so, you know, there are obviously these big trucks are tearing it up. That would seem to me that would be a red flag. It would be a red, deceasing, you know, a red tag would be put on this project just for that purpose, because those roads are not safe. They're not going to be safe. And until that is addressed, the red tag should be put on this permit process for the construction, the deconstruction of these dams. It's time for us to be proactive. We cannot be victims any longer. We've been victimized by the smoke, by the forestry, by the fires. And what else? Let's not take it anymore. Shasta County is not taking it anymore. They're having an extensive meeting today that I was going to be down there with today just to applaud them and also to learn from them what they're doing. But this seemed to be more important to me this morning to be here. But, you know, I would implore you to talk to the supervisors in Shasta County and get information on what they're doing to take their county back. And we need to act as counties together to fight against the communistic movement of California. Thank you very much.
Anyone online? Showing
none online.
All right, thank you all for coming. I appreciate the effort and the time. This will be the last special meeting for the year, so we will continue this up sometime next year and look for the scheduling of that. With that, we're going to close session.
Hey, check this out.